community resilience. Our recommendation from staff tonight is to adopt the draft resolution adopting the 2026 Emergency Operations Plan as the City of Itasca's official all-hazard emergency guidance document. That concludes my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, does any member of the council have questions of Fire Chief? Councilmember Funk?
Yeah, we'd spent quite a bit of time looking at this as a council on a preliminary basis and at our strategic planning session back in January, I guess. Could you, so I'm not going to rehash anything from there. Could you note any major changes from what we the council looked at that time?
No major changes. I think the review is continued. We've brought it since then at the department head team has reviewed it, and the disaster preparedness committee has also reviewed it, and we found, you know, minor grammar type of things, but no changes to the structure or content really.
Okay. And do our the appendices and annexes and all that, does that include something that addresses the role of ham radio operators in the community?
They would be mentioned in the under the crisis communications annex. They would be mentioned, yes.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Also would note that the, you know, this entire plan is available in the link on the agenda for any member of the public who wishes to read the entire thing. I want to open this up to public comment, see if any other member of the public would like to comment on this issue. Okay, seeing no one approach, we'll bring it back to council for a motion.
I move staff adoption of staff recommendations.
Okay, I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion by Councilmember Newsom, a second by Councilmember Funk. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Newsom?
Yes.
Councilmember Funk?
Yes.
Councilmember Peak?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Daris?
Yes.
Mayor Bravo?
Yes.
Motion passes unanimously.
Thanks. Okay, we'll move on to our last item on the agenda. That is the 2045 Tascadero General Plan Fiscal Impact Analysis Overview. And I'm going to turn this discussion over to Mr. Phil Dunsmore, our Community Development Director.
Thank you, Mayor and Council. Yes, tonight we're going to overview another portion of our general plan update, and this time the fiscal analysis. And tonight I'm going to basically talk about the land use plan a little bit as a basis for the fiscal analysis, tell you about some assumptions the analysis makes, and then talk about next steps as well. Now, a lot of tonight is really based on assumptions. It's really based on the crystal ball. And this is really a tool for us to analyze how the general plan is going to work for our future. What's it going to do in terms of the costs and the benefits of our assumed land use plan? So it looks at whether the forecasted growth generates sufficient revenue to offset municipal service costs. This isn't a required action, but it's something we want to do as a city. It's something our council wants to do. And it's really another tool in our toolbox to assist us in making decisions, and it helps us adjust where necessary. So the key findings, I'm going to start out with that. And also, I wanted to mention, too, online tonight, we have our consultant that helped us prepare this analysis from EPS, Megan Gregory, and I think she'll be available. We can have her hook in a little bit here when I'm done. She can help us answer any technical questions as well, so we can do that. I'll give you just some key findings. In summary, the general plan update, the 2045 update, is projected to have a positive fiscal impact long-term to the city's general fund at build-out. When I say build-out, that's the assumption that we put into the general plan of what we think is going to happen in 20 years. And that could result in as much as $9.9 million in new annual general fund revenues, about $6 million in annual municipal service costs, and a net positive impact of approximately $3.9 million. And I'll touch on the fact that is based on us even increasing our staffing and service levels a little bit above beyond levels today and keeping up with the population trends. Now, this is all based on a scenario, a land use scenario, that assumes a mix of commercial, single family, and multifamily uses. If land use trends lean one direction or the other, obviously the fiscal impact would likely change as well. But based on history, based on what we're setting up for zoning in the future, this is what we think is going to happen. This is our land use plan that we have run our environmental impact report on. It does change zoning in a lot of the areas that are close to the core, that are close to El Camino, that are close to Morrow Road. It brings in additional density. It brings in additional residential, mostly in the form of mixed use. This general plan, as a reminder, doesn't really change our single family areas a lot. We do still have single family that's going to be developed in the future in the city. We can also see accessory dwelling units developed in the city. So a lot of the west side isn't changed, but the areas close in are changed a little bit. And the city, I say this every time we have a discussion about the land use plan, it's not substantially growing. We're not adding new land to the city. We're not annexing land. You know, Eagle Ranch still sits out there as a someday maybe potential. But this is about looking inward to our city and increasing the quality, increasing the opportunity for new growth for business, and increasing the opportunity to mix residential with commercial. So over 20 years, under this scenario of the assumption, we could see up to 2,890 new residential units, a lot of those being multifamily, very few of them being single family. And when I say multifamily, some of those can also be small lot, single family residential. About 1.5 million square feet of non-residential development or commercial development. Not a lot of that's going to be all retail. We think of commercial as well as being roll-up door space, light manufacturing, could be office, could be different kinds of things. And we do expect additional tourism. Obviously, the economy swings up and down. But we should see over 20 years up to 225 hotel rooms and new various lodging accommodations. Now, when we look at residential, it produces mixed fiscal outcomes. Single family generally is a positive fiscal impact, whereas multifamily, especially the higher density and more affordable housing, those costs exceed the general plan revenues. The city has to spend more money on supporting those than we actually make. Now, the ultimate fiscal impact really will depend on when and how much of each residential unit type is actually realized. But luckily, the fiscal impact analysis did have a nice summary in table two. It's in your staff report there, of what some of these things look like by land use. And I circled in green and red there, the positive and negative, the highlights there. And so the market rate, single family unit, and we spend probably just about $2,000 in supporting that through various levels. And the revenue, you know, the tax revenue from that is about $2,500. So there's a positive impact of approximately $427. Whereas you look at some of the multifamily, and it's the reverse. It's, you know, between $300 and $600 in the red by what the city costs, what it costs the city by what we would achieve from tax revenue. And look at the retail, though. And this is per 1,000 square foot, positive, 7,320. One of the reasons why revenues drive land use. And so, obviously, retail is going to do really well. So are hotels per room, as much as $4,500 annually. It's quite a lot. It's pretty interesting. So some baselines for these assumptions. Right now, city staffing levels are really strategically aligned with the current budget to ensure sustainability. Ideally, and made this more conservative, we would expand staffing levels to help achieve more optimal service and operational needs to keep up with what's happening, what trends are happening in our region, keeping up with other cities as well. So the fiscal impact analysis does assume some moderate additions of personnel to meet these service demands and workload in line with general plan build out. But in summary, and I think we've played with this back and forth quite a bit, and I think as you'll see in a bit, one of our council members too went above and beyond and showed us a sensitivity analysis by adjusting some of the land uses to see how, you know, when it would break, when do we start really losing money? And you can go pretty far with this. So what we find is that growth enabled by this general plan update is fiscally sustainable and produces enough resources for services and reserves, even if we don't see this assumed land use pattern. We can play with it and get more housing, or we can get less commercial or more commercial, less housing, and it still becomes fiscally responsible. So just a big picture of where we're at right now. We just finished the environmental impact report, public review period. The draft EIR is done. We're working on the final document now. We only got three letters, which is fantastic. And the three letters we usually expect, one from Caltrans, Fish and Wildlife, and one from Tascadero Regional Water Company. So they weighed in on some topics and had some comments, not a huge deal. We are still working on draft zoning regulations. We've been bringing pieces of that to you. And we hope to bring a big chunk of it, if not the whole thing, back to you in August, not for final approval, but for a final look, and before we commence everything for the grand finale in September. We will have the entire general plan, the entire EIR, and the zoning, but you'll have seen bits and pieces of that all year long. So hopefully we're ready to go at that point, and that's our goal. As always, project website is up at Tascadero2045.org. You can always give us a call. You can always stop by. You can always even have a coffee with us at one of the coffee shops downtown and ask us questions about the general plan update and how the zoning's coming along. So that's it for me. Happy to answer your questions. And our finance director is very well versed in this as well, and she's here tonight, in addition to our consultant from EPS. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Dunsmore. And is the consultant online at this point for questions? Okay.
Luke says yes.
Okay, excellent. Well, I'm going to start on my left see if council members have a question. Councilmember Peake, none? Mayor, none? Okay, I had a couple questions, and I'll pass it to my right. When we talk about capturing, two things. One is the daytime service population defined as the total residential population plus 50% of total employment, because obviously people come and work in Atascadero who do not live here. But one of our underlying problems in Atascadero is a bad jobs housing imbalance, in that every morning thousands of Atascadero residents get up and go on the road and go work in another community, typically San Luis Obispo, and far outnumber the number of people who come and work here, and which is something we're trying to address through this plan. But so I'm wondering about that daytime service population, because we have a population of roughly 30,000 people, but in the middle of a weekday, there's less than 30,000 people here, whereas San Luis Obispo has a population close to 50,000 people, but on a given weekday in the middle of the day, there's probably 70,000 people in San Luis Obispo. So I'm wondering how this assumption was arrived at and how it affect the fiscal analysis, because obviously there are people come and work here that don't live here, but they're more than offset by people leaving in the morning. So I'm wondering if you or the consultant can address why that is kind of phrased in that way or derived as a daytime population.
I am hopeful that our consultant can give us a more eloquent answer on that one, but I will tell you, we do have the second largest employer in the county here at the Tascadero State Hospital. But still, even with that, we are assumed to be a bedroom community, and a lot of folks do pour out. And we're seeing that in our numbers. So Megan Gregory, perhaps she's online and perhaps she can answer how that analysis assumed that daytime population and what numbers we looked at there.
Yeah, I can. My apologies, my camera has decided that it didn't want to work right when we were starting this particular item. But the service population is generally seen as the total residential population and half the total employment. And that's the typical formula we use for fiscal analysis. I believe that daytime doesn't necessarily mean like in the middle of the day. It's more like on any given day, what is the service population? And so we generally think of a resident as sort of our baseline for that service population. And then we think of our employees relative to that resident, if that makes sense.
Well, I understand how it was calculated. I just, didn't understand why that metric was used, given that, again, our underlying problem is a poor jobs housing balance, that we put thousands of cars on the road every day so that on any given, you know, normal weekday, there are less people here than our population, not more people here than our population. And I just want to make sure that it didn't result or skew in any way the projected expenditures or anything like that.
It shouldn't, because we calculate it, we treat the existing in the same way that we treat the calculated projected numbers. So any change to that calculation, that formula, would impact both.
Okay, thank you. Another question on page 226 of our agenda, references table 14, says 30%, an assumption, key assumptions include 30% of new residential spending and 50% of new employee spending is captured in Atascadero. I'm wondering how that number was arrived at. Again, we historically have not had a real strong retail sector. We have substantial retail sales leakage to San Luis Obispo and Paso Robles. We hope to improve that. We hope to better that. We've made some progress on that. But I'm wondering how the figure of 30% was arrived at for residents and then 50% for new employees. And I assume new employee spending is considered at a fraction of resident, because people are going to spend money where they work, but not as much as where they live, I would assume.
Yeah, so. I can take that. And then Phil, if I miss anything, feel free to jump in. The net new household retail sales, the 30% spending capture, we are seeing, that's a general assumption that we've used, like I said, in a number of these fiscal analyses. I think it is an apt one for, we expect the households to spend a portion of their retail dollars at local stores. We looked somewhat at the retail makeup of Atascadero and the neighborhoods where we are anticipating some of this development to occur. And they were close to some general retail. And then additionally, we looked at kind of what Atascadero is capturing now, in terms of retail capture in comparison to its market area, and what we would expect. So there were a couple of different components we considered as we sort of centered into that 30% number.
Okay. So is it safe to assume, though, that if we are successful in attracting more retail, you know, as indicated in the report in terms of per 1,000 square feet, that hopefully that 30% number could change to where the average household is spending more than 30% of their spending here in Atascadero?
Yeah. And that number will often depend on sort of the actual tenancy of that retail. And so if you get retail that's very attractive and new and competitive in the larger market area, you'll see a larger percent of that. Or if it's filling a hole in sort of retail that people currently have to travel outside of Atascadero to get, but now they can get it in Atascadero, that might increase as well. So it's kind of what ends up filling that space that'll determine that percentage.
Right, but it sounds like, you know, the number is based on as we are now, which makes sense, but I would hope it would change as we've noticed, you know, we've added more restaurants. I think more and more people think now about, you know, dining out in Atascadero. They're not their first option isn't to think about going to another town, because we have more and more dining options. So hopefully we're capturing more and more of the dining out dollar. So as an example. Okay, thank you. Those are my questions. Councilmember Funk, you have questions?
Yes, just a couple at this stage. And I want, first of all, big thanks to staff, both Director Dunsmore and Manager Lewis, for spending time with me at a detailed level so that we don't all have to go through all of what I asked. Following up on the mayor's question for a second, that 30% in residential spending, how does online spending figure into that number? And Megan, you can answer that.
Yeah. I believe we would generally consider online spending outside of that 30%. However, if there are cases of ordering for local pickup, like if you're ordering pickup at your local hardware store or something along those lines that would fall under a local sale in Atascadero, but stuff that is coming in from outside of Atascadero would not be included in that number.
Okay. Then let me ask, since retail is the single largest category, could you expand further on what the definition of retail is and what the mix of that retail is, gas stations versus restaurants versus stores where you buy stuff?
Yes, I believe I would say that retail is, we are generally considering to be commercial space where there are sales occurring, taxable sales occurring on site. We do assume that 5% of what we're calling new retail space would be owned or operated by a nonprofit organization. So that can be a variety of sort of service places, service establishments that would be exempt from sales tax. And so that is included in our estimates of on-site retail sales. We do kind of net out that square footage. Yes, but I believe retail can is covering a variety of commercial uses.
Wondering if staff would like to elaborate on that. In particular, I'm recalling from other reports that we've received that the number one sales tax category in our community is gas stations. And as people start switching over to electric cars, consistent with the state's incentives and guidelines and so forth, with or without the support of the feds, as people make those switches, people are paying less in gas tax. We're having less, that affects sales that are sales tax that we would be receiving from gas stations. How vulnerable are we to that effect?
I might defer to Director Dunsmore for that question, but I believe in this context, we're looking at the additions and the changes with the general plan, not the existing kind of gas station changes, and that would probably be a different modeling of our general fund revenues.
Okay, so the bottom line is, since we're probably not going to be adding a lot of new gas stations with the land use changes that are made in the general plan, then we're not, this impact is not really vulnerable to that switch over from gas to electric.
Correct.
Okay. I do also want to ask a question about the mix of housing that's included here, because we had quite a discussion offline about the below market rate housing mix, because most of the projects that are waiting to be developed at Atascadero, expansions of Haslow properties, a people's self-help housing project, so forth, most of that below market rate is financed through federal tax credits and occurs in big projects. And the assumption here is very different, that this will be mostly housing that's occurring in the context of commercial development. Is it fair to say that the main reason that the expected mix of below market rate housing occurring in our, because of the zoning changes in this and land use changes in the general plan, that the reason it's set up the way it is because most of that's occurring in mixed use land use categories, and that's and the not-for-profit developers tend not to do mixed use land, so we would be expecting that to be commercial rather than not-for-profit.
Councilman Funk, I believe that's a really good analogy. Yes, we do assume that a large portion of multifamily is going to be above commercial, and generally these nonprofits are going to prefer the larger open vacant land, such as the surplus land at the state hospital. Now, it's possible, sure, there is going to be some additional affordable housing projects taken on by the nonprofits, and we welcome those in our community. They really help us with our RENA numbers. And we did assume a portion of those in this analysis, but we also do assume a significant portion of really specific zoning that we're putting in place that's going to allow, like you said, a lot more of this mixed use and a lot more of these projects that are integrated with commercial and a lot of these things that are going to be by right on these smaller lots that are infill. And those tend to not attract the nonprofits, but they're just a different mix of multifamily housing.
Okay, great. Thank you for explaining what the assumption that I found really counterintuitive.
If I could interject on that, I'd like to ask a follow-up question. When people self-help housing builds, you know, 40 units somewhere, let's say, what's their property tax status on that? Because I'm wondering, when we talk about below market rate, some of that is where a developer in being allowed to build is setting aside a certain number of units. But when an entity like People Self-Help builds, are they paying property tax on those units?
They're exempt. So nonprofits are exempt. And also the other big land use that's exempt very often too is a lot of these big medical offices now that are owned by nonprofits are also becoming
right. So it's an Adventist as opposed to a tenant.
Correct. Yes.
So I'm wondering, given that much of the below market rate multifamily housing that's built is in our community is done by entities such as People Self-Help Housing, is this revenue picture actually too high for those if we don't get property tax from those?
We do assume some of the nonprofits built into this, but the BMR that's on this particular chart, when you see there's a 1027 or 1027 revenue, that is assuming that those are projects that have affordable housing in them because of our affordable housing ordinance. That's not assuming the nonprofit, is the way I understand that in that particular chart. Okay. So if I had nonprofit affordable housing up here owned by one of those nonprofit companies, yeah, it would be a zero in the revenue.
It could be a zero or near zero in the revenue.
Yeah.
And so the impact would be a further negative. I think we all appreciate what People Self-Help does, but I think we need to be clear-eyed about the fiscal impact of those units is considerably more negative than what's displayed here.
They're expensive. Yes. Needed, Mayor, but expensive. Yes.
If I may add, and maybe the consultant would like to add, but we did have that very discussion and with concerns that we didn't want to overstate property tax revenues for those. So there is a percentage, and I can't think of it now, but our consultant probably can answer that question on how much of that we kind of discounted just for those types of entities.
Okay, great. Good to know if taken into consideration, and if the consultant could address that very quickly, if you know a number.
Yes, I believe the number is about 5% of total commercial uses are expected to be owned and operated by tax-exempt nonprofit organizations. As I believe Phil was mentioning, we expect the 100% affordable housing, the tax exempt affordable housing, we're not currently assuming that will occur within the zoning changes of the general plan update, and so it's not reflected in this model currently. But that is, there's definitely a consideration to be had around that regarding the fiscal impacts.
Okay, thank you. Yes, because I mean, realistically speaking, much of the below market rate housing that is built in our community is through nonprofits like People Self-Help. So, okay, thank you. Sorry, Councilmember Funk, I interjected into the middle of your question. So did you have any other questions? You done? Okay, great. Yeah, we'll kind of come back to you in your spreadsheet. So Councilmember Newsom. Okay, thank you. We're going to go out and see if there's any public comment on this item. Anybody wishing to speak, please approach the podium. If you do want to speak, please get in line at this point in time.
Good evening, Council. Jeff Oslin once again. I have a few questions. Build out is based on what percentage? What happens if this build out is 70%? What's that do to revenue? That would be question number one. Question number two is this taking into account if Eagle Ranch comes on board or not? Also, fire station number three comes on board. I understand that we did build in some staffing, but I think those are prudent questions to that. And then the spend per household concerns me a little bit in town. As Council Member Funk alluded to, we could have more electric vehicles on the roads, not just living here, so we have less tax coming in on the gas tax. The other one would be retail delivery, because I think we're going to have a hard time selling all the retail space that we may be building. And I drive through San Luis Obispo once a week, and they have a ton of housing above retail and a lot of vacancy. So it's a concern if those numbers are not right. The other one would be, we all know things are transitioning for basically daily delivery, meaning a drone might be dropping something from a warehouse off at your house at some point. And that's not going to be coming from our city of Atascadero, because we don't have a lot of space for industrial warehousing. So I'm just wondering, on a 20-year plan, can't do the crystal ball, as Phil says, but are we taking some of these things into consideration? Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker, please. Oh, can you pull the microphone a little closer to you? Okay, you got it on. Great.
Good evening, City Council members. My name is Grant Dunn. I'm here tonight to ask the council to adopt a comprehensive three-tiered framework that sets aside specific city parcels for affordable housing for youth, elderly, and disabled residents. To achieve this, we need a diverse approach to ownership. I'm asking you to direct city staff to utilize city land for three distinct models. First, community land trust for single-family homes and accessible cottages, allowing our seniors and disabled neighbors to own their structures and modify them for long-term health without the burden of high land cost. Second, limited equity housing cooperatives, which lower the financial burden to entry so our youth can collectively buy equity in multifamily buildings and establish roots in our city. And third, deed-restricted homeownership parcels forced into new private developments, ensuring our vulnerable populations are integrated into modern, accessible, master-planned communities. Rental options are temporary band-aids. By setting aside land for these three specific homeownership models, you give our young people, seniors, and disabled community members a permanent stake in our city's future. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Anybody else wishing to address the council on this item? Okay, seeing no one else approach, we're going to close it and bring it back to council for discussion and guidance. This is not an action item for council, but it is for us to address, make sure we understand it, and provide any further questions or comments to staff. I know Councilmember Funk had worked on a spreadsheet, which actually I think partially addressed one of the issues Mr. Oslin raised, which is what happens if, you know, this doesn't happen, and it won't happen, frankly, in terms of every category being built out to the max, build out and you know, identified here. So, you know, there, nothing ever is going to happen completely 100% to the way it's, you know, laid out. So, Councilmember Funk, you developed a spreadsheet that kind of tested what happens if some of these things happen to a different degree. So would you like to discuss that briefly and the conclusion, which I read and understood? So
thank you. And Steph is setting things up so I could share this. I'll be brief on this analysis, but in the course of my professional career, I have built many models for business clients to enable them to ask exactly the kinds of what-if questions, and to stress test the assumptions that go into complex models, the sort of things that Mr. Oslin was asking about. And, you know, I deeply wanted to know that. So first, what we see here, if you look at your printed copy, you'll see this information in Table 5. basically the layout of table 5 in the packet, and then the row up at the top here are the volumes that are in table 6. So all of the data that's included in this model is stuff that's publicly available in the staff report. And because I am presenting this here at council, this model itself will also be available to the public, so anybody have a burning desire to run scenarios for three of us in the world that are interested in this. So what I did with this is to take the per unit assumptions of revenue and costs on table 5 and multiply them by the volumes of those different uses that we see in table 6, and then also include in there a percentage. So first of all, we could test the very question that Mr. Austin was writing. What if this development moves out and we don't get some of these things that we're planning on? How sensitive is this to the volumes of various plans that we have in the assumption? And then the second thing I did was to take this and do a set of scenarios that also made the individual assumptions variable, so that we could ask questions like the mayor was asking, well, what if we don't get any property tax from these below market units instead of getting property tax? How badly does that hurt us? And my conclusions from this, really, I did, first of all, we see up here I did plus or minus 20% on every single land use category. So that's the question. What if it develops a lot less than we're expecting? What if it develops a lot more? And then looked at what's the plus or minus 20% swing. So that's a pretty big range of impact. And what we see here in this column, plus or minus 20% swing, is that on all of the housing categories, although we make money on some, we lose money on some, none of them are really large impacts. So if those numbers develop out more, faster or slower or with a different mix than we're expecting directly, nobody should lose any sleep over that. It's just not that big an impact. The second thing is when we look at the, the larger things, so where is there real impact? My natural assumption would have been to look at the hotels. And yes, that does have an impact. But the big impact is in the retail, is in the use of the new commercial spaces. So what that tells me is that we as a council, we'll want our staff to keep an eye on that one thing, to look at how the land uses we're creating in these commercial spaces are working to create, these mixed spaces are working to create vibrant commercial spaces that actually get occupied and used and generate tax revenues in our. And the other thing that is worth paying attention to, from my view, is we need to watch the impact of one decision this council made, which is, we looked at in the areas of El Camino Real where we're converting commercial zoning to mixed use zoning. We're looking at a lot of underperforming commercial spaces, that aren't real attractive and probably aren't going to be real competitive over time. And we took that whole land use area and said, as a council, that those could be first floor residential in those mixed use. If you remember or can look up which zoning we had like 4 or 5 different mixed use zonings, and to just generally remember which ones the council directed would be first floor residential options, or if that was all of them. You can think about that for a second if you want. So we'll come back to that. I surprised you with that question. But it suggests that this isn't, that we may want to watch that over time, because if that all of that grows in is only commercial, is only residential, and we assumed it to be a mix of residential and commercial, it could get to a point where it would have a significant impact.
But the bottom line is there's a fair amount of flex in the sense of, you know, there being a significant amount of less or more development in each category, and it would still be a net positive impact, financial impact. And that was very important to us in terms of the overall financial impact of our general plan update. And we, you know, we already had given council or staff guidance on certain zoning definitions, et cetera, sort of in response to the one gentleman's questions or requests. And this shows that, you know, there'll be a net positive fiscal impact. And your analysis shows that even if that, you know, varies from the scenario shown in the report, it's still going to be turn out to be a net positive unless things went way off track, particularly in the retail arena.
And by the mayor's leave, if I could have a couple more minutes to address some specific scenarios, just so that we know that I looked at some, you know, per unit scenarios. So what happens if a lot of our housing develops with people who bring in Prop 13 assessments and, you know, pay less property tax because they're baking in special deals from wherever the housing that they've owned so far. And what if all of our below market is owned for not-for-profits? And that scenario does reduce, you know, our projected impact, but it still leaves over $3 million positive impact. So all the basic scenarios that I ran that you see listed here, you know, what if we only get 70% of the hotel revenue that we're expecting, even though the hotels all develop? Now, it, you know, all of those scenarios are still substantially positive. The one that's, you know, a little trouble is, you know, if all the revenues are up 20% and all the costs are all the revenues are down 20% and all the costs are up 20%, it's still a positive impact to the land use changes, but we would, you know, probably we wouldn't let that just happen. We'd take action. And then last, I want to make mention what happened to try to get a worst case scenario. What I had to assume is basically to get a impact that was negative, had to assume that we would have, let me go over here.
Well, you had that narrative comment there that
addressed. Yeah, I have it in the comments. So basically assumed we get none of the hotels, we get half the offices and industrial, we only get 28% of the retail that we're hoping to have, but we get twice as much below market housing and 150% of the other multifamily housing and only half the single family housing. That's almost impossible to achieve when most of the housing, a lot of our multifamily housing and all the below market rate basically is going to be occurring in mixed use developments that have commercial and housing together. So that's where that's for me, it I concluded this is really robust. And we are unlikely, you know, in any scenario that we can really identify, unlikely to have this plan grow us into trouble fiscally.
Yeah.
And previous situations have done that, where councils basically forgot to build a tax base community, and we've lived with the effects of that. So now we're really, this is a solid plan, and I feel very comfortable with it.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, the bottom line is a lot of things can go, you know, in a somewhat like a negative direction from the base scenario, and we would still have a net positive impact.
Yeah.
And so I think we can all feel pretty comfortable that overall the guidance we provided for the general plan update is going to pay off with, you know, an increase in revenue and with that, the ability to provide increased services. So I feel comfortable about the council. Do you have any questions? Mr. Council. Okay, seeing then, staff, you have what you need from us in terms of the input. We've really not provided you any guidance or input, but
this is really just for us to view and contemplate. And I will say that, you know, there's a lot of things that aren't considered here because they're difficult to quantify. I mean, when you add more residential, you generally have more people shopping and doing things in your community and buying gas and all those other things, and you can't get every number. A lot of these things are just pure tax revenue, and it's hard to get all those other factors that are in here. So there is some positive even for a non-tax revenue residential. The other component too, I wanted to answer Councilman Funk's question on the mixed use. There is a mixed use zone that will allow for solely residential under a discretionary permit, but that's only a very small area, a couple tiny areas where we found that the commercial districts are very small and couldn't really support a substantial commercial use. There's some areas just north of downtown and just south of downtown where the lots are very narrow and shallow, and where the commercial is really watered down. Those are the spots we pinpointed for that to be a potential. And there were some areas too where residential can share some ground floor area with commercial, but it can't be all residential. And some of those areas are on Mora Road. But again, it usually falls into a discretionary category when it's got the residential on the ground floor and there has to be a predominant commercial land use. And we're working on refining those standards right now. When we come back to you with the final version of the zoning, it'll have that in there. And it'll be an important piece to look at.
I did have a question for you, Mr. Dunsmore, or the city manager. In the table, you know, where it shows the estimated net impact of the different categories, showing single family market rate having a positive impact of $427, et cetera, along with the retail having a substantial, you know, benefit there, as you see, $7,000 per 1,000 square feet. I'm wondering if this is should push us to revisit the issue of the community facilities district charges, particularly in the downtown area for mixed use properties, where because of the positive impact of the retail component, you know, that would offset, let's say, where even the negative impact to a large degree on some of the multifamily. And so the CFD that we charge, community facilities district, that we impose, particularly in the downtown area, is that something that could or should be revisited as a result of this study?
I think that would be something the council might want to consider and give us direction on. I think these are numbers now that we've seen that do show for every 1,000 square foot of retail, there's a significant benefit. And you can see then that several units of housing above would impact, but could still, based on your policy or guidance, create a positive development. We've heard that from some of the owners of those developments in the past. I believe we are one of the only cities in the area that does a CFD on that type of use, especially in the downtown area. So I think we were waiting on this chart. A couple of you have asked me about that. I think it is something worth considering, but it would have a significant impact on the general fund. And so that's something the council would need to consider.
Right. But I mean, you know, the CFD is based on the premise that, you know, these new developments don't generate enough revenue to offset costs. So we have to charge the CFD, and this study would sort of undermine that to some degree. So I'm looking to see if council would feel that staff should come back at some point in time, you know, in the next 6 months, and, you know, analyze that further and come back with a recommendation or an option on how we address that.
I think that the analysis supports that action. With the caution that the mix of what goes into that retail makes a huge difference on the level of profitability to the city. So I would ask staff to be nuanced in looking at that, because if, you know, our retail is all coming from gas stations, and what we're putting it over are, you know, our yoga studios, then we're not getting getting the payoff that's assuming. So,
yeah, I think that would be, if you wanted us to look at this, there's direction to do that. I think this is the time to tell me that. And I think Councilman Funk, you're right. If we were to look into a program like this, I think because when you were discussing mixed use projects a couple weeks ago, you were very flexible on that first floor for office or potential residential. And I think in that use, the CFD would still be required. However, if a developer wanted to set forth perhaps a restriction that the first floor and record that would be restaurant retail sales tax generating, and they were able to commit to that, then that perhaps might be a trigger for waiving the CFD, and it ensures we get those types of uses in certain places.
And I think that what you just discussed would be part of the analysis we'd like you to take a look at in addressing the issue. But I for one would like to see you take a look at that in light of this and potentially bring it back to us for discussion and potential action, let's say, within the next 6 months, if that seems. Yeah. Do I have
I'm totally on board with that. I think it's a great idea.
So, okay. Good with that? Okay. Looks like we have consensus to do that, Mr. City Manager. And with that, I think we're done with this item and we're ready to proceed on to council management or council announcements and committee reports. We'll start on my left, Councilmember Peak.
The RAC Water Resources Advisory Committee went over the 2026-2027 budget. It was basically it for the meeting. Went to a number of great events this week, much like was spoke about earlier, and looking forward to summertime in Atascadero.
Mayor Pro Tem Daris.
Thank you. Last Thursday, Visit SloCal met the advisory committee. They continue to do a great job promoting our area, the whole county and individual cities and everything that goes on. They do these videos, which they're short, maybe 10, 15 second videos. And it occurred to me that I didn't feel like I really saw them much. And as it turns out, they're on Facebook. I just tuned out advertising. I saw one the other day that they do a great job with those. But one of the more recent adventures that they did was to team up with Firestone Brewery, and SloCal now is a label of beer from Firestone. I've tried it. It's good beer. I recommend it. And I think it's a great promotional thing that they're doing. The numbers for tourism and revenue and stuff, I think, are trending up in everywhere, and including in Atascadero. So they're continuing to do a great job, and that's all I have to report.
Thank you. I have had no meetings since our last council meeting. Tomorrow, I have an Integrated Waste Management Authority meeting, and next week, a Central Coast Community Energy Board meeting. So, Councilmember Funk.
I have no meetings to report. It's been a real busy time for lots of events here in Atascadero and elsewhere. And so I want to just register that deep appreciation to staff for moving all these things forward to get our big public safety facilities. I also want to mention that last night I attended the opening ceremonies for Welcome Home Village. This is a homeless shelter and supportive housing project in San Luis Obispo on the grounds of the county, what used to be a parking lot, right near French Hospital in that area up on. And it's beautifully done. It's first national first 3D printed housing project. And they're looking forward to folks being in there. Real attention to how to create community so that they can get folks who have been encamped along the Bob Jones Trail and get them into shelter, get them into permanent housing, and thriving in places that are better for the community than sleeping on the Bob Jones Trail.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Newsom.
We had a SloCog meeting on the 3rd, no RTA. SloCog, there was a lot of discussion about the RENA numbers and the different cost adjustments and a little bit of pushback and a possible objection letter was drafted as well. That's it.
Did the SloCog board vote to place the half-cent sales tax measure on the ballot? Okay. Thank you. Okay, do we have any individual determinations or actions from councilors? Okay, seeing none, we are adjourned. Thank you all. We'll be right back.
At this time, AM 1230 KPRL concludes this portion of the Atascadero City Council meeting, brought to you by Idler's Home. More of what you want for your home. Go to idlershome.com. We invite you to join us the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for the Atascadero City Council meeting. We now join our regularly scheduled programming. Thanks for listening to The Right Choice, AM 1230 KPRL, Paso Robles, Atascadero, and Templeton.
Construction company. And you said, if you hire an average American worker at a wage and you hire an average illegal alien worker at a wage, which one is going to show up at 6 o'clock sharp, work hard all day, or work till the job is done and work harder? Which one is more likely to work harder?
Well, I mean, I don't know that that's clear. First of all, we're not talking about illegal workers. We're talking about people who come in on visas and their profession. They, by definition, they have to have college degrees or master's degrees. And so I mean, you're talking about professional people, people who are engineers and architects and doctors. And so I don't know that it's accurate that there's this thinking out there that, oh, the foreign workers are going to be, you know, better or work harder. Yeah, we're talking about professional people here.
If you don't work hard and you lose your H-1B, you have to go back home, don't you?
Yes, but you can. I mean, I live in Texas. It's a right to work state. You also lose your job if you don't do your job.
But all I'm saying is if somebody says, hey, we hired Kate. We were hoping she's from India. We thought she'd do a good job. She didn't. So, you know, in this case, we're going to let her go, and then she loses her H-1B, and back to India goes Kate. Kate, that's the concern I've got, is protecting American jobs, and I very much appreciate you coming on. That's Kate Lincoln Goldfinch, an immigration attorney and owner and CEO of Goldfinch Law. Kate, thank you very much. Hey, I can tell you this. If I'm taking a supplement every day, I don't want to just have better numbers on a lab test once a year. I want to feel that difference. And that's why I stopped wasting my money on fish oil. I kept hearing omega-3s were good for me, but I never noticed more energy, less stiffness, and real relief. So I dug deeper, and I found Native Path Antarctic Krill Oil. This stuff is on another level. Krill oil is up to 50% more absorbable than regular fish oil. That means your body can actually use it. And in head-to-head studies, krill oil beats fish oil for supporting healthy cholesterol, reducing inflammation, and easing joint pain. I'm talking about feeling better when you wake up, move around, and live your life. Plus, no scary side effects. Right now, I want to get you 60% off, free shipping, and a full 365-day money-back guarantee. Go to nativekrill.com/Lars and get up to 60% off. That's nativekrill, KRILL.com/Lars.
The Lars Larson Show.
Brought to you by Central Coast Tractor Work. Brush removal, grading, trenching, mowing, and more. No job is too small, and they work weekends. Clear tonight and overnight, lows in the mid-50s, upper 90s. Sunny on Wednesday, Thursday, sunshine, low 90s. Weather was brought to you by Central Coast Tractor Work. Call 805-440-6361.
Is this a sign you need a sign? The Blue Printer and Graphics in downtown Paso Robles can help your business be seen. In addition to flyers, business cards, invitations, wine club signups, and blueprints, the Blue Printer and Graphics offers vinyl banners, PVC, coroplast, and metal signs, as well as full-color posters. Check out their new website at pasoblue.com. That's pasoblue.com. And be seen with the Blue Printer and Graphics in downtown Paso Robles.
Savage Spirits and Deli on 21st and Spring wants every military person to know that you get a discount at their store.